I'm at the emergency room, no big deal. I'm just here for a totally normal childhood injury. I don't know if you guys remember my son from episode 3. He was the one who's going to have 10 kids. We're here at the emergency room at the Children's Hospital, which there's a nice feeling being surrounded by other parents and children and siblings. I wasn't sitting here thinking, oh, this is good podcast material. What happened was I went to the cafe.
Your dad.
Oh, thank you. To get a snack and some water, and the guy behind the counter handed my son a piece of chocolate. I said, oh, thank you. And he said to me in German, he said, they're our future, pointing to the child. I guess it just is making me think a bit about resilience.
This is episode 4 of Certain Futures. As I was sitting in this waiting room of the children's hospital, the thought I had was like, oh, this is resilience. There's these other parents and their children and the siblings. There was a family that seemed to have come like directly from a work Christmas party, just judging by their attire. I watched this one teenager who was leaning against his mother in a way that he probably hadn't done since he was little, or at least since he was last sick. And there was this couple there with this little baby, but, you know, they were still managing to laugh despite the fact that they were probably intensely worried. And here's the thought I had. It was, oh, this is resilience. This is what resilience looks like. And I think most importantly, this is what resilience feels like. So everything has gone wrong. We're all here together on what is a terrible day, or, you know, like potentially maybe a very nice day that just took a sudden turn for the worse. There's doctors and nurses here, probably short-staffed, probably overworked, but they're all doing little pragmatic things to make it work out better. And I see people helping each other and getting through this. And in this moment, it felt reassuring. And like, not just that I live somewhere where I can get healthcare for myself or for my children when we need it, but also as we look ahead into what seem to be massive challenges that we're being presented with, you know, resilience isn't preparedness. Resilience is something you're inside of when something's gone wrong. When I started this project, I thought I was going to be talking to scientists who could predict the future. And as soon as I got into my first interview, I found out, like, not only demographers can't predict the future, but also in a sense why this is a good thing.
You know, you use the term guessing, you know, I trade in uncertainty. I'm comfortable with that term.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure all of my colleagues would, but I certainly am.
This is an excerpt from my interview with Jakob Bjak. You'll have heard his voice in episode 1. He's a professor of statistical demography at the University of Southampton in the UK.
Once you realize that things are uncertain, things are complex, nothing is ever simple in this world, chances are that the decisions that will be made by policymakers will be at least more robust, but also they will honestly acknowledge that we don't know everything. And, you know, as always, there is a tendency to propose some simplistic solutions that will not work. So the challenge is, from our side, academics, to avoid the illusion of prediction. So the fact that, oh, you know, we can predict the future. We can't, of course we can't. At least not in a precise sense. But at the same time, from the client side, from the policymaker side, avoid the illusion of control. The thing that, you know, if we pull a policy lever here and another there, we will change the demographic trajectory. It's not as simple.
At some point, you know, theoretically, given perfect information or whatever, what would be the harm in saying that you could predict the future?
I think that's the illusion, right? So that would lead to complacency. And the fact that if we were working under the illusion that we can predict the future, we wouldn't be prepared for the unexpected. And the unexpected would inevitably come at some point.
I didn't expect to take this subject matter personally. I thought this was a project about data and numbers, and studying people in the millions. And it immediately became something that I took very personally. And I mean, I think we all kind of have an impulse to center stories around ourselves. I know I have that impulse. When I went back to the Futurez offices and spoke to Kate and Peter, who had assigned me this project, I wanted to know if this had also been their experience. At what point in working on this did you guys experience a midlife crisis that ballooned into an existential catastrophe?
From the get-go, I was. Yeah. I mean, just to learn that we're aging since the day we're born was a hard fact for me to accept.
Well, I felt like that was a positive thing for me. I'm like, I'm aging. And then someone's like, no, you were always aging. I'm like, oh, okay. That's not so bad. Yeah. So basically at 44, I'm the same as I was at 4 or 14 because I'm still just aging.
So I think one of my midlife crises is like this idea of like, oh, all we have to do is get the best experts and then communicate what they have to say as efficiently as possible to the people who make the changes, and then everything's going to be all right. And then you get to these meetings where the policymakers say, yeah, we know, and we're trying, and we've tried out a bunch of things, but because societies are multifactorial things where a bunch of stuff interacts, and as soon as you put out a policy, people react to it in a certain way that you can't really predict, We've tried. It's not working. And then you're like, oh, it's not about the efficiency of communication only.
Right.
It's also about like keeping on trying. And that was kind of humbling. Because as a communicator, you usually tend to believe that the only problem is that people haven't been explained stuff in the most fun way. You know, we all have these moments where we're like, oh, if only they would understand, if only she would understand, if only he would understand. But it's sometimes not as easy as that.
Because sometimes they do, and it's still not enough.
Because sometimes they do, but sometimes they're just also coming from a completely different place than you are. And sometimes, also because we're in Europe, sometimes the Berlin solution is not a solution for a French village or a Polish city.
My empathy for those policymakers also increased when I was like, people have been telling me to save for my retirement for the last 30 years, and I've kind of blown that off. So like, maybe don't judge Italy so hard. Or, you know, these mathematicians or economists or demographers who are also like in the middle of making their own life choices and balancing work and home and all of that. And not to quote the Muppets Take Manhattan, but as the diner owner in that says, peoples is peoples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're all just trying to get along every day.
In episode 3 of this project, I launched into our discussion of fertility rates by saying, hey, longevity, it's this big win for everyone, right? But I want to bring up something I learned in episode 1. When I spoke with Miguel Sanchez Romero, he's a senior researcher at the Technical University of Vienna, and he told me something super important about those longevity numbers.
So something that we are observing during the last decades is that longevity is increasing differently, both by education, by income, but for most of the characteristics that we can analyze individuals. So something that it can be necessary is to have a retirement age specific by different income groups, for instance, because we know already that there are around 4 to 5 year age differences, according to Eurostat, in terms of life expectancy between those who have less than high school and those who have already tertiary education, so university degrees.
So what you're saying is we can estimate a gap in life expectancy based upon education, at least as a correlation. And then we also then are inferring based upon education how much you're going to earn. Is that what is the other thing that we're implying from that?
In principle, the research is quite persistent. The difference in terms of income and also in terms of life expectancy, ones that we are controlling for education. But it's also true that the difference is even higher if we are measuring life expectancy, not just by education, but by income. So if we are analyzing difference in life expectancy by income groups, one of the extreme cases is already known through research from the US that is showing that the people in the top 1% of the income distribution compared to the bottom 1% of the income distribution, they are already 14 years apart in terms of life expectancy. From wow. birth. From birth.
I had a fantastic discussion about fertility rates in episode 3 with Anna Rotkiewicz. She's a research director and research professor at the Population Research Institute. That's part of a Finnish family NGO. She said something which caught me completely off guard.
I haven't heard anyone say yet that there will be some benefits to population decline.
Ah, oh.
What are they?
Well, the thing is that the rapidly growing population is not always a good thing. A rapidly declining population, it's also probably not a good thing. We haven't experienced it. I mean, some parts of Japan has. If you have a somewhat slowly declining population, you have less pressure on housing. You don't have to build so much more. You can have sustainability gains. You can take part of the emptying countryside and turn it into natural parks. Give back biodiversity. I think the ecologists, some say that it's a good thing if there are fewer people. But as far as I understand, research shows that population decline can be good for nature, but it can also be adverse. For instance, if you just let invasive species spread or unused facilities rot and destroy and spread whatever toxic things, then it's actually really bad for the environment. So it's how we do it. And as a scholar, I think if I will live long enough and kind of see this happening and acting out in many places, I think we also will be surprised by things. I think there will be many unexpected effects. And again, maybe it's easier to predict the kind of more sad ones, like languages dying out and, you know, schools and universities closing and fewer young people around. But I'm sure there will be positive things I can't think of now, too.
In these conversations, which were hour and a half, 2 hours long, my demography experts would inevitably make some suggestions about topics beyond their specific area of expertise. And over again, certain things like the reform of real estate and housing policies came up. And when I spoke with Arnstein Asve, professor of demography at Bocconi University and the primary investigator of Futures, he wanted to talk about education, which was a topic of extreme importance to almost everyone I spoke with. We'll pick up in the middle of our conversation in their very lovely home. He had made me a fantastic cup of coffee.
The other issue is no matter how you try to measure resilience as such, those with higher education are much better at coping with problems. So part of that is that they are better resourced. But if you were going to think about the policy around that, what you would encourage is really to improve and increase education for all.
Okay.
Because if you thought about it as a population policy, a society would probably be more resilient if you had a lot of people with more education than having a society where there was a big inequality in terms of education, so that you had few with a very good education and then you had many at the bottom with hardly any education.
And later that day, I took a short stroll across Milan to Bocconi University, where I spoke to Letizia Mencarini, and she mentioned how a colleague of her from a different department looked at some of the issues we were discussing.
So it's all a matter of of levels, I mean, circle, what you consider, your family, your village, your country, your continent, the world. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is astrophysics.
Okay.
That when I talk about this problem, aging is laughing. I said, who cares? There will be other forms of life.
Right.
In the system.
Right, right.
In it's the stars. Right.
If life as we know it ends, it's just as we know
so
it.
So he doesn't care at all because he has a different perspective.
At the time, this was like just a fun anecdote. But now as I finish this journey, it strikes me how important it is to acknowledge that the researchers and the mathematicians who are working in demography, they're not doing it because they're just good at numbers. I mean, I found that people on the street, typically they understood how the aging of our populations and these demographic issues are creating challenges for Europe. Well, for most of the world. And I mean, it doesn't take an astrophysicist or a rocket scientist to understand that there's a problem. And an astrophysicist or a rocket scientist might be really good at crunching the numbers as well, but just because you can figure out how to get people from Earth to Mars, it doesn't mean you have what it takes to understand making life on Earth better for all of us. Earlier this episode, I mentioned how I took all of this very personally, and so did these experts. I hadn't considered going into this what the personalities of the people I'd be interviewing would be like, and it was a really, truly pleasant experience, and I mean, like an unexpected delight. I mentioned this to Kate and Peter at their offices.
If you're a numbers person, there's all kinds of things that you can do with your numbers skills. And to choose specifically to go into a social science and to understand populations, I think there's more motivation than just I'm good at math. There's also right. Like, I want to understand people. I want to understand populations, societies better. There is a little bit of a utopian moment in it, even though not every person might, you know, see themselves that way, but that's right. The way that I see it.
There's the utopian, at least, aspiration.
Yeah, there's the aspiration of better understanding and the idea, which I think, contrary to what I said earlier, is often true, is that if you better understand, you have a better chance of making things better.
When I began working on this, I looked around and listened to how the crises described by demographers were being covered. There were a lot of announcements that the sky was falling, you know, impending doom. And I knew from a narrative perspective that if you start a story with, hey, the sky is falling, you need to end it with something like, and here's how to stop it from falling. But the experts I interviewed, they weren't here to tell us here's how to stop the sky from falling, because they can't. But, you know, we also don't turn to emergency room nurses and doctors and ask them how to avoid falling on the playground. We don't ask them how to not get the injury that requires stitches. We go to the emergency room and we wait patiently for our stitches. So I think when we consider that the aging of the continent and its consequences are not some distant asteroid that we're being warned about, when we remember that we're already inside of this, we're already feeling the results of this, there's going to be lots of experts with lots of different expertises offering us a plentiful number of solutions. We've got issues you can't put a Band-Aid on, but it doesn't mean you can't apply stitches. And it doesn't mean that you can't create an environment where people are going to feel like things are still going to be okay. And it doesn't mean that the systems we have in place can't improve. I mean, honestly, why isn't there Wi-Fi in the waiting room of the emergency? Maybe it's got something to do with, like, it interfering with the doctor equipment kind of. Look, I don't know. The point is, we weren't in the emergency room because it was on our list of things to do. It wasn't our plan. But all of us who were in there, do you understand what I mean when I say we were all happy to be there? By the time we'd made it into that waiting room, the worst of our day was probably behind us. When you're within a crisis, the perspective, the feelings you have are not the same as when you're analyzing it from the outside. The moment you turn around and see, oh, my 3-year-old son is bleeding, is very different from when you're in a waiting room and you know that eventually someone's going to stitch him up. So, yeah, this is the final episode of Certain Futures. But, I mean, I know I'm going to keep reading about demography and pay attention to these publications and follow the work of these researchers because it's like, super interesting. I don't know. I didn't mean to, like, become a demography super fan yet. Well, here we are. It's important to keep this research going and funded and listened to and that our conversations continue to cross disciplines and mediums and demographics. For Certain Futures and Radio Shpaikov and geriatric millennials everywhere, this is Daniel Stern. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Radio Shpaikov in cooperation with the EU-funded research project FutureVES towards a resilient future of Europe. You'll find plenty of information and links in our show notes, along with more information about FutureVES and Population Europe. And now one last time, I'm going to ask our musician friends at Partifax, who've provided the soundtrack to this podcast, to take the wonderful yet somewhat cumbersome title of a publication that we used in this project and make a lovely and magical little tune out of it.
Europe's challenges of population aging, a migration and automation, possible solutions.
Thanks again for listening.